Okay, well, I actually had not met today's speaker before this morning. I became familiar with Dr. Miller through an apologetics magazine that I subscribe to, Christian Research Journal. I think a number of our folks here read that as well. And I had read some of his articles, noticed that he lived here in the area in West Lafayette, and discovered that he is the president of an apologetics ministry called Rosho Christi. And we like apologetics here. So I'll let him tell you more about this particular ministry, but Created Equal uses some of their materials, and William Lane Craig, of which we are familiar with here too, also speaks highly of him. Dr. Miller grew up in Utah as a seventh generation Mormon, I learned this morning, coming to Christ in 1988. He served on the pastoral staff of four churches, taught nearly 100 college courses in philosophy, theology, rhetoric, and comparative religions at various places, including Purdue. He is currently an adjunct professor of philosophy and comparative religions at Indiana University Kokomo, and he's also the author of several books, most dealing with Mormonism, apologetics, philosophy, and evangelism. Sounds like our kind of guy, right? He holds master's degrees in philosophy, biblical studies, and in philosophy of religion and ethics, and his PhD is in philosophical theology from the University of Aberdeen in Scotland. So it's always a treat to have someone well-educated speak here. We've asked him to come today and share a little bit about his experience with Mormonism and his journey out of it, and then also introduce us to the ministry of Rosho Christi. So let's give him a warm welcome as he comes and shares with us. Dr. Miller.
Good. Well, thank you, Pastor Brain, for inviting me and just having met you this morning as I was walking down the road. Figure out what I'm going to say in a couple of moments, I guess. Very much appreciate this church. Feels very personal. Enjoyed the worship and the reflection time and the prayers and the uniqueness of considering God's character through that time as well. Is the PowerPoint on? Push the button. Which magical button? There it is, right there. All right. So I'll sort of talk you through some of these. Rosho Christi means the reason of Christ. It is not Rosho Dei, the reason of God, but the reason of Christ. We are a Christ-centered ministry, a campus apologetics alliance. So what separates us from the apologetics industry is that we're on campus. What separates us from the ordinary campus ministries is that we focus like a laser beam as a special ops ministry on apologetics evangelism, a particular niche in evangelism trying to reach the university. And we're an alliance. We very much value partnership in our DNA. I didn't arrive at this position willingly. I didn't see myself doing something like this. And in fact, my background was wildly different. I'll tell you a little bit about that. But I recall in grad school at Purdue, when I was working on my first PhD, I only have one. That first one didn't work out at Purdue because of some hostile faculty in my fifth year, which required me to then go on and try it all over again a second time, which is what sort of launched me into this trajectory. But I remember one philosophy colloquium. That is an event that happens about every month, every other month. We'll invite a guest speaker from outside to come in, lecture to our department of grad students and faculty. And this was one of the top philosophers of religion, a Christian from Oxford University, Richard Swinburne. And we were pretty amazed to have him there. He began speaking, and just, you know, 10 minutes into it, I heard this, and I thought, oh my goodness, you know, what is going on here? I knew there were some jerky people in the department, but at least let the speaker get done. See, because in philosophy, the name of the game is, it's a very hospitable non-combat sport. The name of the game is you invite a guest speaker in, as soon as they finish, the first one in the audience to take them down wins. I thought, at least wait till he's done with his lecture. I mean, this is Richard Swinburne from Oxford. And what happened was someone fell out of their chair and was seizing. I had never encountered a seizure before. And it was a fellow professor, one who had gone to Moody Bible Institute and who is now an atheist. He wasn't, you know, exercising a demon out of himself, falling over. He was having a seizure, and all of a sudden, you know, people are in a state of panic, and one philosopher got down next to him to see if he was okay, and he looked up and he says, "Is there a doctor in the house?" And everybody started raising their hand. "I have a doctorate. I have a doctorate. I have a doctorate." Okay, so that latter part I made up, but it was in my imagination at the time thinking, wouldn't it be valuable if we had a real doctor in the house right now? There was a joke running through the department at the time, what's the difference between a philosophy degree and a pizza? One feeds the family. And that was not funny as a grad student with debt and thinking about a future. But it does reflect what a lot of people think about philosophy in our culture. It's that, you know, is this stuff at all relevant? Does it really have any practical value? Engineering, yes. But philosophy, I mean, isn't that just for, you know, quirky people who don't have any personal skills? Well, substitute that word philosophy with apologetics and you run into the same deer in the headlights when you speak in churches. People think, Apollo who? Am I supposed to know her? Should I be apologizing for something? Is that stuff even relevant anymore? One of the churches I was on staff at in the West Coast, that we were on a pastoral staff retreat, and I remember reading this book, Why I Am a Christian, and I'm in tears reading this one chapter by a scholar down in Texas who was a former atheist, and his chapter was Why I Am Not an Atheist. And given my background and thrown into skepticism for a while, I was in tears while I'm reading this. And over my shoulder comes my senior pastor, and he says, "What are you reading?" And I told him, and he said, "Oh, is that even relevant anymore?" He had a PhD from Dallas Theological Seminary. And I just thought, oh my goodness. I'm getting ready to ship off for Purdue because I see what's happening in the secular universities. Maybe I ought to stay in the church. We've got some real need in this culture. But there's also a misunderstanding of what apologetics is, what its role is. Is it really practical, or is it just for a couple of people who are very cerebral in the church, and you know, we find a little small corner for them somewhere in the church to go think about their existence or something like that? It's much more than that. I want to tell you the story about how it's relevant not only to me in my life and how I arrived at where I'm at today, and this organization, but our entire culture. If you haven't noticed, we are on a virtual moral freefall in this culture. And Christianity is viewed more in a hostile sense than it ever has been at any moment in this country. We are really starting to see a future where we might be living in the second, perhaps, century of the body of Christ. When the famous apologetics verse was given from 1 Peter 3:15, Christians are viewed as extremists and as irrelevant. Irrelevant on a good day, but extremists on a bad day. Well, so my background, as the pastor noted, was Mormonism. This latest book that I came out with, I've got two more coming out, one on Mormonism and one on Aquinas and Aristotle and Maimonides. Yeah, what's that? The Leaving Mormonism, Why Four Scholars Changed Their Minds, it was a dream that I had for about a decade to write, but in order to write it, I had to have a PhD. I had that title in mind, because never has a book been written that the authorship involved being former insiders in Mormonism, current evangelicals, and possessed an academic doctorate. I wanted to create a new avenue of conversation for this. And over the last year, it's worked. And I've been able to debate a British UK scholar in Mormonism. I had a debate at the University of Utah with a Mormon scholar and a Muslim. It was a three-way, very interesting. But my co-author, former BYU professor, actually got into Mormonism through her grad work here at Ball State, went and taught at BYU and got led to Christ while at BYU. God works in strange ways. But our story is in that. But my background was steeped, as some of my family say, that I have healthy stock, where one of my ancestors was Joseph Smith's personal bodyguard. As one of our friends and donors up here in Fort Wayne once said, he said, "Wait a minute, you're not going to believe this. Let me just call my niece." She comes over and he says, "Listen to who his ancestor is. The great, great, great granddad is Joseph Smith's personal bodyguard. Now tell him who yours is." And she said, "My great, great, great granddad was the one who shot and killed Joseph Smith." That's up here in Fort Wayne while I was writing the book. And so we took a selfie together, of course. But then he looks at me and he says, "So your great-great-granddad wasn't doing his job?" Apparently not. But having that steeped in Mormonism growth, when I first heard of this Christian gospel, I got suckered into going to a non-denominational Christian camp in California by a friend. I thought I would be spending the whole summer at the beach, which was going to be great because I'd only seen the Great Salt Lake at that point. And if I could do that, that's going to be fine. His dad says, "But you have to go to this camp. I'll pay for it. It's 1 week long. No biggie." I thought, okay, well, I still believe in God. I'm not going to change my religion. I'm not living the most robust LDS or Mormon life right now anyway, but I will. I'll get back on the straight and narrow when I get out of adolescence. But I went down there. The guy spoke on hell. You don't talk about hell in Mormonism. You say that's a cuss word. H-E double toothpicks is how you refer to it. No one you know is really going there anyway, but it's not really a place you talk about. Most people are going to go to one of the degrees of heaven. When I heard about hell, I tell people it scared the hell right out of me and heaven into me. I mean, it rocked my world. And I saw, at the same time, I saw the love of Christ in people, not religion, like I had been accustomed to. And that so transformed my thinking and my desires that I got home that summer, end of the summer, and got permission to go back to California my junior year of high school, where I lived with this family, where I was discipled for a year, a very seminal period of time. Came back to Utah my senior year of high school to graduate, facing off now with a girlfriend that I should not have maintained, a Mormon girlfriend. My Mormon family and my culture now challenging me that perhaps on one interpretation of this doctrine called the Sons of Perdition, I may be worse off than Hitler in the eternal scheme of things. If you know the truth and you leave it, it's not a good thing. Do you want to read through the Book of Mormon again and pray over it and just see? And I thought, yes, I do. So for this time, I read through it for the sake of truth rather than tradition. Long story short, I found it to be severely wanting. Couldn't believe I had been deceived for so long, saw so many problems with it. But what it did is it made me also wonder, okay, I'm glad I left Mormonism, but now what about this foundation to the faith that I believe in historic Christianity? I was raised believing we believe the Bible to be true so long as it's translated correctly, which implies that it's all corrupt, right? But it's not a problem because you've got modern revelation, you've got living prophets, the Book of Mormon, and so forth. Once you throw that stuff out, well, all you've got left is this Bible, and you've already learned how corrupt it is, and you've been betrayed by religion. And so, you know, it made me start thinking, how do I know that the Bible is reliable? How do I know God even exists? And if so, which God? And that sent me into this period of skepticism for a while, until evidence started come pouring in, and God gave me real exuberance and excitement again, and he birthed in me a heart for evangelism. And I used to go on the university campuses, got kicked off, kicked out of the Mormon temple, had my first legal experience at Salt Lake Community College, where they kicked me out of the classroom for proselytizing just because I was kind of doing what the professor was doing, but from a Christian viewpoint. And that one, I brought in legal forces. They backed down, gave me an A for the semester as long as I'd shut up. And so I did. But I loved that engagement. And, you know, went through pastoral ministry, Bible college, things like that. More and more, I kept wanting to get back on the university campus. I wanted to do evangelism. Long story short, I ended up seeing so many of my students falling away from their faith whenever they would go off to the secular baptismal font, I mean, the university. And So I thought, okay, I like the story of the Greeks and the Trojan Wars. They had this Trojan horse idea. They tried for a decade to breach the walls unsuccessfully, but they used this Trojan horse to get in from the inside out. And I thought if I could get a PhD from a secular university, cover over my evangelical past for political purposes, I can get in. And if numerous of us do this, then we can start, you know, reclaiming the intellectual voice of Christ in the universities and defend our own and advance the cause of Christ. And so I got here to Purdue, and 6 weeks into it, I'm getting prank called at 3 o'clock in the morning by my colleagues mocking me for my faith. Second semester, have a Marxist professor put a permanent note in my file that I'm delusional and schizophrenic, and by the fifth year, had my PhD sabotaged, being told I had too much of a quote-unquote faith perspective. So much for free thinking, so much for viewpoint diversity, even at one of the most viewpoint diversity free thought schools in America. And it made me say, wow, it's much worse than what I thought. What ministries are going after professors? Because that's the source of the problem. If you see pollution downstream, you want to go upstream to resolve it. That's the source of the problem and potentially source of the solution, at least one of them. And so went on staff at Campus Crusade for a while, directed the faculty ministry at Purdue, continued to teach at IU Kokomo, where I was subsequently involved in legal proceedings there because a former pastor who turned gay turned me in, saying that I had created a suicidal environment, brought in the legal forces again. Two atheists in my class came to my rescue as well, forced the administration to listen to my lectures that they had recorded, or they would threaten to transfer to Purdue because this is not free thinking if I was, you know, punished. Unlikely alliances. I was exonerated for that one. I've been out there for about 12 years. Still live in West Lafayette. Published this other book, Is Faith in God Reasonable?, based on a debate that I moderated with William Lane Craig and Duke University's department head Alex Rosenberg. And it was on Is Faith in God Reasonable? And the reason I even titled it that is because I was in my dissertation. Part of it was dealing with the virtue of faith. And I thought, I'm going to get to the end and I'm going to have to defend, and it's going to be close. And if they say, this guy really stinks, we're not going to pass him, at least they can say, well, look, he's a published author with Routledge. So I could quote myself a lot if I could, you know, get this book out even before the dissertation. Eventually, I graduated from that institute, Aberdeen in Scotland. 2 months later, this opportunity for Ratio Christi presidency came up. The mind of man plans his ways, but the Lord directs his steps. I never thought I would be doing what I'm doing today. Our vision is thoughtful Christianity. Thoughtful has a double entendre. It connotes to us compassion and contemplation. Consideration, being considerate, and being reflective. Thoughtful Christianity, transforming lives on campus today, changing the culture tomorrow. You want to change the culture, the pollution downstream, you got to go upstream. Our mission statement is a global movement equipping students and faculty with historical, philosophical, and scientific reasons for following Jesus. We're not a bunch of eggheads. We don't want to be eggheads in any case and be in that, you know, corner of the local church where you don't have any personal skills. We want to be evangelists, ultimately. As Epictetus, the Greek philosopher, said, we have two ears and one mouth for a reason, so that we listen more. We want to diagnose our culture, the individuals we're talking with. If someone needs a hug, we give them a hug. If they need an argument, we are the ministry on campus to give them an argument. And we believe that Christianity is true, and we're willing to debate with the best of them. And that little connection with the rings there reflects the apologetics evangelism connection, evangelistic apologetics. It's not just apologetics. It's not just evangelism. Evangelism in and of itself today is insufficient given where our culture is at. The challenge, neo-atheists are evangelizing our children. Old atheists, as opposed to new atheists, they were stuck in the ivory towers. These new ones have somehow gotten the attention down with the masses. As Donald Gray Barnhouse once said, that they, you know, you pull the hay down from the loft so the cows can eat, and eat they are. I see my students in my philosophy classes asking questions and trying to poke holes in the Bible like never before. And on an increasing basis. And I'm thinking, how do they know about these passages when most Christians, because most Christians don't read their Bibles, don't know about these either? And they're learning it from the web, from the new atheists, the popularizers of this stuff that the academic atheists of the past probably are a bit jealous of, never had the opportunity to make the connections. Key finding in research, students leave the faith primarily because of intellectual skepticism and doubt, up to 70% on multiple different surveys over a long period of time. We are losing our shirt on this one when they go off to the secular baptismal fonts. Daniel Dennett said that of Christian parents, for example, they will see me as just another liberal professor trying to cajole them out of some of their convictions, and they are dead right about that. That's what I am, and that's exactly what I'm trying to do. Very candid, what he's trying to do to our children. Richard Rorty. So we are going to go right on trying to discredit you, parents, in the eyes of your children, trying to strip your fundamentalist religious community of dignity, trying to make your views seem silly rather than discussable. You wonder why I call these the secular baptismal fonts? Peter Boghossian was just in a conversation with him last week. Your new role is that of an interventionist, a liberator. Your target is faith. Your pro bono clients are individuals who have been infected by faith. He wrote a book called A Manual for Creating Atheists. And in there he says this is a clarion call for student activists, for university administrators and faculty to target people of faith, to get them to remove faith and import reason. And it's an all-out assault. He's now being assaulted by people more left than him because of certain things that are happening in our culture. You might call it cultural Marxism. You might call it social justice, critical theory, political correctness, or whatever. But they created this animal, this Frankenstein in the university, and now they can't control it. And he's not of the sort that necessarily still belongs when it comes to politically correct, privileged or underprivileged rhetoric. Well, I want to talk a little bit about the church and campus ministry. The church's goal, other than glorifying God, having a relationship with God. Second, to do evangelism, right? And we say that mission exists because worship doesn't. And so you've got the Great Commission. Go into all the world, preach the gospel, make disciples, right? We want to talk about the Son of Man come to earth, and we want people to believe in the Son of Man. But you want me to believe in the man? Yes. But the man is in the book? Yes. Well, I don't believe the book. I can't take for granted what I could a generation or two generations ago. This is not your grandmother's America anymore. Campus ministry emerged in the same way in the New Testament that deacons emerged. Practically speaking, the apostles needed to be able to focus on the word, the preaching, things like that. So deacons emerged. In our last century, youth pastors emerged. A lot of kids now no longer had Christian parents. Christian parents liked the fact that they had someone else in the church to help them out and so forth. It was a helpful thing. It emerged. Campus ministries emerged, Campus Crusade and InterVarsity and others. In part to assist the church going for this upstream pollution center, but in part because it was believed that the church wasn't entirely doing its job either. Now, the typical approach of campus ministries has sort of become obsolete, and Ratio Christi has moved in with this resurgence of apologetics. 1 Peter 3:15 and 16 says, be prepared, and it's not an invitation, it's in the imperative, it's a command. Be prepared to give an answer to anyone who asks you for the reason, for the hope that is in you, and to do it with gentleness and respect. In that passage, we find the head, the heart, and the hands of Christ in one package. It's not one against the other. Our modern evangelical church emphasizes the hands, the food pantry, helping the poor and the widow. Or we emphasize the worship set and the passion, the heart. Did I get anything out of that worship? Am I connected to God? Do I feel God's presence? But we've disfellowshipped that third element, the head of Christ, living in the most anti-intellectual age of the church, period. Which is why Bertrand Russell, the famous atheist, said most Christians would rather die than think. In fact, they do. That's what they think about us out there. On a good day, they see a pastor as someone who is thin-headed but fat-hearted. On a bad day, they see him as a pedophile priest and a danger. We're not living in friendly times anymore. Polls taken, adults in America think that you're an extremist if you proselytize, if you evangelize. 40% of them think that. And think about that, the word extremist, how that's used in our culture. 40%. 60% think if you're a Christian and you do it, you're an extremist. That's a 20% difference from everyone else that gets to be an extremist. Right? But they say, don't worry, you're still relevant. How so? Food pantries and keeping kids off the streets. The moment you tell them why you do what you do, what motivates you to food pantry and keep kids off the street, then you're back to an extremist. You're relevant as long as you shut up and just do socially just things. Right? We're not living in good times. We're kind of living at the time in 1 Peter where the church was persecuted. And he said, be prepared to give an answer. In this time, a reasonable response from the hope that's within, and do it with gentleness and respect. And Justin Martyr, born the year John the Apostle died in 100 AD, gives two letters to the Roman Senate and the emperor called his apologies, saying, we're not bad citizens. We're not what you think we are. We can be the best of citizens. Christianity is true, but we can't declare Caesar as Kurios or Lord, but we can be good citizens. In fact, when no Roman centurion is watching, we can still obey government because God is watching. Gave apologetics then. In an era when Christianity was viewed as a nuisance and as a danger, was it relevant? Was it good? There are three areas where apologetics works itself in. Pre-evangelism. Oftentimes we look at this as removing obstacles to someone coming to the faith, right? Every generation has their new set of defeater beliefs that are opposed to them, that are charged against them, right? And literally, this is what apologetics is in the New Testament. It's mentioned about a dozen times. It comes from apologia and apologetamai, the noun and verbal forms in particular, more than a dozen times. And it literally means to give a defense, as in a legal court of law. You're being charged with something. You're giving a defense, right? And in Romans 1, it talks about this evidence for God around nature, inside and outside. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. Literally, they are unapologetos. They are without a defense. It is literally indefensible. We are giving a defense. We are not bad citizens. We can be the best of citizens. Christianity is good. It's not evil. It's not wicked. And it's relevant. In fact, look at all the hospitals. What are the names on them? Richard Dawkins, Bill Gates? No. Methodist this, saint that. What about the universities? Virtually all of them started out for the first 150 years in America as Christ-centered. All of the European ones. All of them in South Korea and in India. We were the ones who began those. Christianity is irrelevant. It's true. Pre-evangelism. Some of the charges in our culture today, probably the top four or five, are the Bible is not reliable. Science has made God irrelevant as an explanation. Maybe God is not real because science is real. The problem of suffering and evil mitigates against God being good and all-powerful. How could all this stuff be happening and God be present? The exclusive truth claims of Christianity that Jesus is the only way makes you a bigot, a wicked, hateful, harmful person. Those tend to be the charges that Christians are now called upon. It's demanded of us in our culture to give a reasonable response before they can seriously check in with Christ, because they think these are insurmountable obstacles. It's not only demanded of us in our culture, it's commanded of us in Scripture.
And then sometimes it happens not just in pre-evangelism, but in evangelism proper. If we're talking about evidence for the resurrection or the identity of Jesus, and we get into the death and resurrection of Christ, well, what are the implications, theological implications of those in the atonement? The gospel sometimes is concomitant with or simultaneous with apologetics. And then there's post-evangelism, right? Happens after, in this case, with believers. Belief comes not just in terms of content, truth, or falsity, but in degrees of certitude, right? If you know something, you've got 100% certainty. Most of what we take ourselves to know, we don't know. We just believe. You can't know anything in science, for example, or history, math, logic, you can have absolute certainty. But other than that, if you believe something, it's between 51 and 99%. You're not likely to act on it if you're at 51%. Apologetics serves to confirm, to buttress, to support, to reinforce belief to the point of action. Gets you up to 70%, 80%, to 90%. Right? If Jesus walked in here now, this would rock our world. It would change me. I would go out living differently. Apologetics can help that. And so it's relevant before you got saved, during your salvation, and after your salvation. It is relevant. It is demanded of us. It is commanded of us. I don't get born with it, perhaps. I got to do my homework. Speaking of the universities, just to use Harvard as an example of where we're going, where we've come from. In 1636, note that date, more than 100 years before the founding of this country, Harvard was the first university. It was founded as a center to train missionaries and pastors. It required its freshmen to take Hebrew. And its motto was Veritas Christo et Ecclesiae, truth for Christ and the church. Started out Veritas for about 10, 20 years, but it was founded by the Puritans. And that was capital V Veritas, or capital T, truth. All truth is God's truth. That's what they meant by it. It quickly added for Christ and the church. And it kept that for 300 years until 1936. That's when stuff started to unravel. It kept it for that long. Churchill said that the empires of the future will be the empires of the mind. Now, note the date that that came about. And then within 75 years, the single largest religious category reveals that of the freshman class of 2019 in Harvard, that's coming up, so I'm giving you anticipated knowledge they've already done studies on, there will be more atheists and agnostics than Protestants and Catholics for the first time ever. It's continuing to devolve in that way. Say something about this generation and the one that we're, the millennials and Gen Z. The millennials born 1981, 1996. You've heard a lot of bad stuff about them in terms of its relational connection to the faith. Yeah, we've largely lost them. And we've lost them for the same reason that we're not going to lose Gen Z. Gen Z is already gone. It's a matter of if we're going to let stay that way and see two generations in a row and the total collapse of a culture going forward. Gen Z is who's in our colleges now. The millennials are gone. They're literally, they're out of college. If they're there still, they're in grad school. But they're not the focus anymore on campus ministry. It's Generation Z. In Emory White's book on Gen Z, he discusses sociological reasons why perhaps we lost the millennials and what characterizes Gen Z. And it is the idea that for so long we were offering food that wasn't relevant to the consumer at the time. We assumed an Acts 2 model. All the believers are there. We go to the synagogues and we grow from within. A group that already assumes God's existence, the Bible's general reliability, some basic moral tenets of Judeo-Christianity, So you could just drop in there, give the gospel, connect with the heart, four spiritual laws, and boom. And we wondered why we'd have harvest crusade after harvest crusade after harvest crusade, and yet people weren't really coming to the faith. As any farmer in Indiana knows, you can't keep harvesting if you're not sowing seed, and seed of the right kind, right? We abdicated our role and responsibility in high culture a century ago and gave up the influential posts of culture like media, education, government, arts, and so forth. And now we're long since kicked out of it, trying to get back in, trying to even get invited on campus. But we were offering something with assumptions that the culture didn't even believe. Now, what characterizes Gen Z is, and I'm so sorry for this, I thought that the slides would be bigger. It's 26% of our population. And the top five characteristics is, it's the iGen, right? These are technical people. When I run into problems, I ask my kids, my 9-year-old, my 13-year-old, or my 17-year-old to help me out. My wife does it as well. Second, it's multiracial. Next year, whites from K through 12 will be the minority in the country. So it's a very diversity-centric generation. It's sexually fluid. 73% of Gen Zers embrace gay marriage. 73%! That's going to have huge sweeping implications on the electorate. And then socialist in terms of economic inclination. They were raised in recession. They hear these buzzwords about being social justice, socially just, helping the poor, things like nothing wrong with helping the poor. In fact, a lot of good with that. But they're more inclined toward a socialist economic. And more than any other feature that characterizes Gen Z is they are post-Christian. First generation in the history of the country to be like this. That needs to rock our world in terms of our methodology and our approach. It gets worse than this as well. In Yale's 2017 study, a broadly national study of students, 48% support campus speech codes. Now, we just won a federal case in Georgia over this. We've been in 17 cases of legal proceedings. We just won a federal court case because they kept our pro-life display back to the back end of the campus where no one walked at all, and they did it 2 years in a row. We pushed the envelope 15 times. They capitulated, different universities. That's how you handle a bully. You don't, you know, give in. You push back. The only legal permission we need is the Constitution, thank you. Not this university, not this city, not this state. So we push back. We fight it rather than capitulate. This time they decided to take us on. We sued. We won about 4 months ago. Last month we just sued again at the University of Colorado for speech. For the all-comers policy, the idea that to be a permitted organized club on campus, you have to say that your leaders don't have to be Christians. That's just stupid, right? On the face of it. So they've had us off for 3 years. We're suing. We think we're going to make that one. That's the kind that we need to go big to the Supreme Court eventually and liberate the entire left coast where we're currently off campus, force the 9th district. But 48% of Gen Zers support campus speech codes. There are certain things you shouldn't be able to say on campus. Whoa! 81% think that words are a form of violence. And so you can start to imagine with political correctness what kind of words can you or can't you say. And 33% embrace physical violence being justified to prevent people on campus from giving hate speech. Why was I charged with creating a suicidal environment? It was hateful. I use atheistic texts. I use pro-homosexual texts in the classroom. And when I just gave an alternate perspective, that was hateful. It was harmful. It created an environment that was inclined toward suicide. Wow! 66% of hate speech is defined as anything that student believes to be considered hurtful to a particular person. And who defines those things? This is the Generation Z that we're talking about right now. Michael Bloomberg, and again, I have to apologize, I'm reading through these to you anyway. Bloomberg, he's just a recent 2020 candidate, former New York City mayor, considers himself liberal. He spoke at Harvard, and he said that this is a good school, but it's not a great school, because while it embraces diversity in a certain way, diversity of gender, ethnicity, and orientation, it does not embrace the diversity that a great university needs, viewpoint diversity. He said that conservative faculty members are at risk for becoming an endangered species. When 96% of all campaign contributions by Harvard and Ivy League faculty are given over to Barack Obama, something tells me they're not getting a fair shake in the political science departments, he says. That's from Bloomberg's perspective. And about viewpoint diversity, liberal to conservative professors are the ratio 2-1 in the 90s. It's now 12-1 for those who are 65 and older getting ready to retire. And the younger professors coming in, 36 and under, it's 23-1. And in religious departments, it's 70-1. We're facing some radical times. And so for parents, for pastors, this is like an impregnable fortress that we can't get over. And so what we've done for Ratio Christi is our college prep ministry now sees not a 70% fall-away rate. We've got a 90% plus retention and then plus growth. University chapters on 150 universities. Our RC professor, if we can develop a movement of missional professors, we can win the professor and win their classroom too for 30 years. I just want to play this one video and we'll culminate with this. This is a student who got saved at Purdue, future professor, now has his PhD. If you can play that, it'd be great. It's 1 minute.
Ratio Christi means the reason of Christ. And I realized that's what I was missing and that's now what guides my life. I'm Dan Mizell. I'm a PhD student at Purdue University, and I was an atheist. So I did a lot of searching in secular philosophy for what the basis of morality should be. And I was always disappointed because it always came down to presuppositions. An absolute morality cannot exist without God's existence. And therefore, my belief in an absolute morality, my feeling that there should be an absolute morality, was pointing me to the existence of God. I finally opened up and prayed to God that if He was there, that I needed help and I needed guidance, and I was lost without Him. And immediately after praying that, I got this overwhelming sense of calm. Going to Ratio Christi meetings has really been a great benefit to me, because not only do I now have the basis, the rational basis for belief in Christianity that I was missing initially, but I also now, if I encounter someone who's having similar doubts to myself, I now have the tools that I can help them through the same struggles that I've struggled with.
We had an Acts chapter 2 model. It didn't work for the millennials. It will not work for Gen Z. We need to pivot and have an Acts chapter 17 model. Two ears and one mouth for a reason. We read our culture and we realize Acts 17 is where we've been for quite some time. We need to get with the program on this. In our churches, in our campus ministries, in our culture as a whole. This is not our grandmother's America anymore. You can't do evangelism, not effectively, without at least having apologetics as part of your tool belt anymore. I'm convinced that most people don't do apologetics because they don't do evangelism. If they did evangelism with any depth, any conversational depth, you can't get away without answering these questions now, especially on the campuses. And so if you go to ratiochristi.org or you just go to YouTube, we've got over 160 videos that are by experts, 28-minute segments each on a whole host of topics. If that can help you, if you're interested in our college prep, if you're interested in helping us out, we would love to plant chapters at universities and colleges up in this area. If you're retired, get refired up before retiring or while you're in retirement. We could use help as a young organization, even with data entry stuff from your home. In any case, look, we've got a culture that is going through moral freefall right now. And if you want to see this changed,
the university is an impactful place to do it. That's why I'm doing what I'm doing. That's why Ratio Christi is doing what it's doing. But as a church, we need to be engaged in apologetics, in a defense of the faith. It doesn't mean you have to become an intellectual fathead. That's not the goal. But you need to be able to intellectually articulate the faith in accordance with the audience who's asking the questions if the evangelism seeds are going to take root. Thanks.
Amen. Amen.